Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast. Looking at Credit Suisse trading in Switzerland, 3.645 Swiss francs. That is unbelievable. For one of the leading financial services companies in Europe, one of the two stellar investment banks, wealth managers in the country of Switzerland, I need to figure out what's going on because I saw this headline on the Bloomberg Terminal. Credit Suisse saw $88 billion outflows as confidence slumps. And I remember from the great financial crisis, when you see headlines like that, whether it's Bear Stearns or Lehman, that's when it gets really ugly. Allison Williams, she's a senior global banks and asset managers analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Allison, how bad are things at Credit Suisse?
I mean, those outflow numbers were stunning this morning. And to put it in perspective, the outflows, just in these several weeks are more than the inflows of 2020 and 2021 combined.
Oh, boy.
And, I mean, I guess the good news is that they said that things have stemmed but not reversed. And so they had said in October that they saw outflows in the first couple of weeks. They pointed to social media and a lot of the reports at the time that, I think this is similar to what we've seen in the past where headlines can kind of drive actual risk to the fundamentals of a business. And they had pointed to that. But I think certainly no one expected the severity that we saw.
So let me just take this down to the very basic level for those of our listeners who aren't well-versed in Credit Suisse. You and Paul obviously know the bank inside and out, but Switzerland has two big banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, and their big businesses are wealth management. They take care of money for high net worth individuals stemming all the way back to the days when you had numbered accounts and everything was super secret and your money was safe there, right? So the concern is those rich people, international wealth, they're pulling their money out of Credit Suisse because they have existential concerns. Is that right?
It is right. I mean, again, when the headlines were coming across, talking about, the headlines really focused on the bank's need for capital. Obviously, that's something that concerns investors.
They've had so many crises. They've had huge losses tied to Archegos and other sort of big giant hedge fund scams and bad risk management, and now they need to raise $4 billion.
Correct. And so, the good news is that they are on that path. So they are trying to steady the downside, if you will, in terms of shoring up the capital. The bad news is they announced a $1.5 billion pre-tax loss for the quarter. I think consensus was about 730 million francs. So that is a step back in terms of some of the capital that they're raising. It's unclear what types of charges might be included there, but the concerning thing at this point is just, as I said, the fact that we're seeing outflows or they're seeing outflows in their core business. So the wealth and asset management businesses, as part of the new strategy, are businesses they're focusing on. They're restructuring the investment bank, but they're going to see a loss in both the wealth unit and the investment banking unit in the quarter. And so the key for them is really going to be to reverse course with the with these flows. I think that's
right.
Not only is it a bad quarter, but the flows are sort of an indication of business health, and so that sort of is cast doubt on the overall strategy going forward.
I mean, clients pulled $88 billion. They need $4 billion in capital. Clients pulled $88 billion out in a few weeks.
Crazy numbers. Allison, I think what I learned, one of the things I learned during the great financial crisis is when other firms won't trade with me, that's when I really got a problem. Is Credit Suisse at that point yet?
Well, I guess the important news is that they've really moved away from a lot of those businesses.
Okay.
So prime brokerage is the most prone to those concerns, right? So if your hedge fund clients start pulling balances from you and won't trade with you, things can very quickly unravel. But they exited that business after the Archegos hit. They announced that they were exiting it, so that business, 98% of revenues had already kind of gone away. And then the securitized products trading business, which is another big business for them, is a business that they're selling to Apollo. The interesting wrinkle there is that it was originally supposed to be Apollo and PIMCO, but it seems like we haven't gotten any financial details yet there, but it's really Apollo that's going to be taking over that business. And so the trading effort that they're retaining is really slimmed down at this point.
And Allison, 30 seconds, is there any chance the government steps in here one way or the other, either supports the bank or allows a merger with UBS?
I don't think they need to at this point. That's always something that's a consideration. I don't think that they would force a merger with UBS, and I'm not sure if that necessarily solves anything. But again, we do need to see things righted, but the capital raise and all the business changes that we just talked about, I think, are going to help limit the downside there.
All right, good stuff. As always, Matt, Allison is on a vacation day today, a tea day, yet she still makes time to talk to us, so we appreciate that. Allison Williams, Senior Banks Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She's old school. She works big time, folks. She's been covering the banks for decades, first at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, where she was the shareholder of some of the major banks around the world, and now as Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Banks Analyst based in our Princeton, New Jersey office. Good stuff to check in with Allison. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Looking at the Bloomberg Dollar Index, it's off about 5.5% from its recent high. One of the drivers fueling, a little bit more than a 10% pop here in the S&P 500 index. I want to get a sense of kind of what's going on out there in the markets on a day-to-day basis. We do that with Vince Signorella, global macro strategist for Bloomberg News. Vince, have we seen peak U.S. dollar, at least, maybe, I don't know, for the short term?
Yeah, I think so. You made the point about the higher S&P 500. They've been in a reverse correlation, an inverse correlation since it was from March. It resynced in August. It's holding for now. And with a bid in risk, I would expect the dollar to continue to suffer.
Talk to me about the Bloomberg Dollar Index itself. What's the differentiation here between that index and the DXY, which used to be kind of the traditional street benchmark?
Yeah, well, you're actually talking to probably the expert on the subject. The Bloomberg Dollar Index was derived from the Wall Street Journal Dollar Index, of which I am the co-inventor.
Very cool.
The difference is it includes many, many more currencies than the ICE Dollar Index. The ICE Dollar Index was recently revamped. It was initially based on just four currencies from basically trade data in 1972. The dollar doesn't move so much on trade data anymore. It moves on financial flows, fixed income flows, et cetera. Trade does affect the dollar, no doubt. But the financial flows are a much, much bigger effect, and that's what the Bloomberg Dollar Index has taken into account, including more currencies. So it's a much broader level for the dollar. The ICE Dollar Index, I think these days 58% of it is composed of a euro. So it's almost really a euro index than it is a straight dollar index. But it is widely traded, so it does get a lot of press.
But the thing is, it's often quoted, right? I'll hear Tom mm-hmm. throw around DXY instead of BBDXY, and then I think, Tom,
use the
that is not as useful, you know?
Yeah, I think that's just old habit because it's been around for 50 years. And the Bloomberg Dollar Index is, you know, a handful of years. I mean, they've retroed it to capture the past, but it's realistically only been around, I think, since 2014, off the top of my head, something like that. So and the ICE Dollar Index obviously traded heavily on the ICE platform. It's just old school, old habits hard to break.
So, you know, Vince, I've heard increasingly, I guess maybe since the great financial crisis, a lack of liquidity in quote-unquote the market, whether it's fixed income, maybe
especially
equities,
in treasuries. That's the thing that I keep hearing.
But I don't hear about it in currencies. Talk to us about how liquidity has evolved across, you know, certain asset classes over the last dozen years.
So if I showed you there was a little red book that used to go around every year, and it was done by a bank that no longer exists. And what it did was it captured all the banks that traded foreign exchange all across the world. And it was roughly an inch thick. And so liquidity was very back thick in the 80s and 90s because you had all these banks around. Now liquidity is pretty much provided by give or take 10 major players, but the volumes have risen considerably, and that's because we've gone electronic as opposed to people trading over a telephone. So the market's grown to like $5.3 trillion, and its liquidity is provided pretty much by 10 players. And they're there making markets all the time, except for when the market moves abruptly. So where
they're
you,
just not there when we need them.
Right. No, that's totally true. So like if I were making a price to, you know, XYZ Corporation back in the day, and they dealt on that price, whether the market moved or not was my tough luck. Now, as soon as the electronic markets trip, and whether it's algo driven or a big order driven, whatever the case may be, if that price changes, the electronic platform disqualifies or DQs the trade. So the corporation or the bank that's trying to deal on that price doesn't get that price. They get the next one. And it could be kind of far away if somebody's doing enough size. So, you know, in a way, the market makers, or I should say the takers of the market, the corps, the financial companies, et cetera, in chasing the banks to do tighter and tighter and tighter spreads, they actually hurt themselves because now the liquidity shortages work against them when they're there because the market moves abruptly and they don't get the price they think they're going to get.
And this is how we get things like, remember when oil traded negative?
Yes.
Just no liquidity there.
And Lisa Abramowitz was paid to take a barrel of oil.
She still got it in her apartment.
That's where you get those so-called fat finger trades, if you will.
Good stuff. I'm sure I would have been a victim of that at some point. Vince Signorella, global macro strategist for Bloomberg News, joining us here, giving us a sense of what's happening out there in the markets. And again, the The Bloomberg Dollar Index, BBDXY, on your Bloomberg terminal, it's off about 5.5% from its just recent high of several weeks ago. It's off about 0.5% today. So a little bit of a pullback in the dollar. Proving to be one of the drivers here, as Vince was just mentioning, of stocks actually out there. So interesting to see that correlation coming up. I'm going to call that WTI crude oil. It's off 4.7% here. $77 for WTI crude oil. That gets my attention.
We are sitting in the studio here, me and Paul, with our friend Katie Greifeld. She is a cross-asset reporter, so she's across everything from single stocks to ETFs to crypto, and cats. She covers cats for us as well. But
What is it with the cats?
Well, Cats and Coins is the name of her newsletter.
Oh.
Would you like to join?
Love to.
You don't subscribe?
I don't.
Oh, I read it every Sunday.
It's actually a pretty exclusive list. If you would like to be on, you have to tell me your work email, and I will add you.
Okay, good stuff.
By the way, you say that a lot.
Yeah.
Do you not send it to personal emails?
I used to send it. I got a lot of Gmails, and then the Gmails on the list got a little weird. So.
Oh, I hear
you. Now you have to send me your work email so I can keep you accountable.
Okay. Let's talk about the latest in the FTX saga. Just when you think you can't get any more news, Sam Bankman-Fried goes and writes a letter to employees.
Yeah, he certainly did.
Has he lost it?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like this would be shocking in any other case, but, you know, he was tweeting so furiously for so long, furiously just describing the pace. It's probably not too surprising to see him formalize his thoughts in a letter. I don't think it was received that well, necessarily.
I can't believe it was. now, he points out that they had, and you got to take whatever he says with a grain of salt, right? Because he still maintains that they have $9 billion in assets.
Yeah, it is.
But they had 60.
He did. Yeah, it's interesting to see, I don't know, what reality he's operating in versus what reality is coming to light. In court, we did have first day motions yesterday. And again, the FTX lawyers have made very, very clear at this point, SBF does not speak for FTX or for Alameda and is not involved in these processes.
Do we have the authorities? I don't know which authority it would be. The FBI, for example. Has anybody sat down with this guy, brought him into the office in New York, in Washington, D.C., in Miami, wherever? I know he's in, I guess he's in the Bahamas is what I hear. Mm-hmm. And said, what's going on here?
I believe they would like to. I think U.S., the DOJ would like to meet with him in New York. I remember reading that story last week. We know that Congress would like to as well.
It's the Bahamas. It's not like he's on the other side of the planet
I've been there. It's not too bad of a trip, really. Yeah. It's not that far.
Go get him.
In terms of
You know what? His parents need to go get him. I mean, we can sit here and talk about the fallout from the bankruptcy. It's massive. A lot of counterparties had serious exposure. What's happened to Genesis? What's happened to Gemini? Mm-hmm. The customers who got the short shrift. I feel horrible for them. But the bottom line is his parents need to go get him. That's a child.
I know.
You know, my youngest brother is either 36 or 37. I can't remember. But he's still a little kid.
Yeah.
Like if something this happened to him, I would go and physically get him and bring him home.
He is. He's 30, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's he's only slightly older.
I don't understand than me. I don't understand the legal side of it. It was there fraud? I don't know. It sure just from reading looks like there may have been. So why is, you know, you go get Bernie Madoff on, 67th Street or wherever they grabbed him.
They got him pretty quick.
Yeah,
Madoff. Remember
exactly.
That? It was only a matter of days.
But you know, I look at Bitcoin. It's up 1.7% today, $16,400 a coin. It's kind of holding in there. It's down from the 20,000 level. But it seems like the market, investors haven't bailed on all things crypto. If I look at Bitcoin as a proxy.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of the interesting subtexts that's going on. I know we've discussed this on this radio, talking about how is Bitcoin so resilient right now. And actually, Kathy Wood of ARK Investment Management was on Bloomberg Radio and TV yesterday, and she addressed that the Bitcoin blockchain, the Ethereum blockchain, they've been running very smoothly. So this isn't necessarily a Bitcoin problem. This is all of these centralized sort of monstrosity conglomerate sort of companies.
100%. This is a point I make constantly.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it doesn't matter your take on Bitcoin. You can believe it's a Ponzi scheme. You can say it's worthless. I can understand the arguments on both sides. But at the end of the day, this isn't about how Bitcoin performs. Yeah. This isn't about how Ethereum performs. This isn't about how Dogecoin performs. This is about how an exchange, a centralized exchange, duped so many people into thinking that it was running an orderly business.
Exactly. It's more about the systems that have spawned around Bitcoin. But Bitcoin itself, I mean, it's just a ledger. It's just basically a data center. And it hasn't had any issues. Whereas you think of some of the other blockchains, I mean, unrelated to this entire blow up over the past 3 weeks. But the Solana blockchain, for example, that had to be shut on and off many times during the summer. Different blockchains have run into different problems at certain points. But Bitcoin, Ethereum, no such issues. So you look at the price of Bitcoin, and there are still a lot of whales out there, for example. I really think the marginal seller at this point is gone. If you're looking at this news and you're sitting on Bitcoin still, you're probably a true believer. You've forgotten your code, or you bought it $7 or $100, right. You know? So you're not going to sell.
All right, CZ.
CZ.
Is this guy, and I don't know his name, but I'm just going to use his initials.
That's the cool thing to do.
Is he just, is there any reason to believe
former
that he's
a Bloomberg employee, by the way?
Is that right?
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, cool.
You did not know that?
I did not know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he used to work here.
So is there any reason to believe that he's more legitimate, less legitimate of than versus SBF?
Well, his business hasn't blown up.
That's right. And so
he doesn't have customers who just lost millions of dollars.
So is he the kind of lender of last resort? Is he a savior for this
I
space?
I think he, in a certain way, has enjoyed portraying that. And it's interesting. There was a Bloomberg News exclusive that Genesis, in trying to raise $1 billion in fresh capital, there had been talks with Binance. Funding failed to materialize. I don't think we can call him the lender of last resort, because you look at what happened
He's never been that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think there are any saviors left at this point, at least not in the crypto world.
I notice is I don't see, for example, JP Morgan stepping in,
exactly.
Citibank stepping in, saying we're going to backstop this market, provide some liquidity. I just don't see any of that. And that to me, maybe it's just I'm just too old school, that's a little bit of a warning.
But the market doesn't need backstopping. That's the thing.
The market does not. It was
these
just
companies.
There's no liquidity necessary. Yeah.
Okay.
They just took everybody's money, put it all on Black 21, and lost.
What
it looks like. I mean, I haven't done any forensic accounting here, but it seems like forensic accounting would be very difficult.
But at right. this point, in terms of the companies, when you think about who Genesis is probably trying to raise money from at this point, it's probably traditional finance players. It's interesting that no one has stepped up. But then you think about Sequoia having to basically come out and say, I'm sorry, we did a bad job of due diligence here. That's probably, I don't know, spooking a lot of maybe some of these would-be saviors otherwise.
Matt Levine's money.
Money stuff
yesterday, which is a must read every day. I have my alert set up. He basically says, you know, the industry doesn't need more Bitcoin, i.e. CZ stepping in. He needs dollars, like the stuff that I haven't, you know, the people actually can spend, and that's what it really needs. And so we'll see how that plays out. Katie Greifeld, cross asset reporter, joining us live in the Bloomberg
Interactive
Brokers studio. We appreciate that. Gold star.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Let's bring in Matt Siegel now. He's the head of digital assets research at VanEck. He's been on the street for a solid 15 years. Before that, he was a producer here at Bloomberg, and he also worked for the Money Honey, she worked for him.
Yeah, back when.
Over at CNBC.
Yep.
But it's great to have you back in the office, and especially to focus on the crypto story. You have been in the space for a long time. The kind of, I don't know, what does Cathie Wood call it? You've been on the cutting edge, right, of the sort of future investments. What do you think about where we are now in crypto? I mean, is there a future, or is FTX kind of the big bang that's going to end it all?
We're in a deep crypto winter, and that's going to be the time when the news flow is most negative and it's easiest to become a hater in the space. So we're dealing with kind of three concurrent major stories here. The first is, you know, the apparent fraud and siphoning of funds by SBF and his family. And, you know, recovery of that may impact the recovery in the bankruptcy courts. And since there's so many counterparties tied into this, whether it's BlockFi, Voyager, et cetera, that has implications for the recoveries going forward, is whether or not he is charged and his personal assets are seized.
On recoveries, I have a lot of listeners writing in with the same question over the last few days and really the last couple weeks. How likely are customers to get anything back, to recover assets?
The recovery process in these cases, like Mt. Gox, can stretch into 6, 7, 8 years. It could be longer than that with a case of this complexity. We have visibility of FTX customer and bankruptcy claims that are trading, you know, at 3 to 8 cents on the dollar. If you're buying them today, that's the type of recovery that you might
expect.
That's
a Matt Miller haircut right there, 3 cents on the dollar. But Mt. Gox, what was the final outcome of that? I mean, that's been now a decade, right?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the claims that
Mark
were paid
Harpellis,
out. Yeah.
Magic the Gathering Online Exchange was what Mt. Gox stood for.
And okay.
I think they recovered a significant amount. And, you know, in the Madoff case, there were real recoveries here, there. But from what we know so far, from what we read and hear from John Ray, like, there weren't even records kept at FTX. It's going to be difficult.
Yeah, there's, you know, multiple loans made between counterparties owned by the same guy that were not disclosed to institutional investors when private shares were sold in the market on U.S. soil last year, breaking the terms of service that were pretty clearly written on their website. Hard to see it any other way that he is personally liable for a big chunk of this.
It looks bad for Sam Bankman-Fried, at least from this perspective, which I guess is why he's still in the Bahamas. Is this a critical moment for the industry in terms of perhaps regulation? And should this industry be regulated? If so, is there a consensus who should do it?
Well, let's just take a step back and like talk about the two other big stories that are going on besides the FTX bankruptcy specifically, and both of them are connected to regulation. You know, the second is that there's a hacker who stole funds off the FTX exchange, is still currently holding about $250 million worth of Bitcoin and Ethereum that he or she has laundered through a mix of second-tier exchanges and
bridges and blenders. And, you know, my question is, are we sure now that that was a hack? And I know that in his kind of off-the-record Twitter DM interview with Vox, Sam Bankman-Fried did say it was a hack. But some people have speculated that the Bahamian authorities may have instructed FTX employees to move assets.
That's a separate sum, where the Bahamian authorities have now, it seems, capitulated and will let the bankruptcy take place in New York. And so we should get visibility into those funds. But there's this other $300 million in Bitcoin and ETH that's been laundered. It looks like the way that the Lazarus Group, which is connected to North Korea, has laundered funds in the past, at least according to U.S. authorities. But tracing and potentially getting hands on those funds could also impact the recovery in bankruptcy in a material way.
But you can always see them, right? I talked to one of the co-founders of Chainalysis yesterday, and he said, we have our eye on those assets. We're not going to lose sight of them. It's not like these blenders are sophisticated enough that they baffle us. It just makes it more difficult.
Yeah, and you've got conflicting jurisdictions on the regulation side. So will it be the same parties who are going after that funds as who are investigating SBF? We don't know. And a lot of the reason for that, as to your question, is that the regulatory landscape is very fragmented. Right?
So you said there's two other issues. One was the hack.
One's the hack. One is the fraud and the personal taking of funds by SPF. And then the third is Genesis, which is, you know, the largest institutional counterparty, the only full-service regulated crypto prime broker in the U.S. And it's hard to do business as an institutional investor and not touch Genesis in some way. They also have connecting claims to BlockFi. So all of it kind of culminates in the FTX bankruptcy, yes.
Yeah, so a lot of bankruptcies here. If you want to do business in this country, I guess, in crypto, you have had to deal with one of those counterparties, right?
Yes.
Maybe Jamie Dimon was right, at least at this stage, which is like...
You've thought he's right since the very beginning.
I don't know. I mean,
J.P. Morgan just filed for a Bitcoin wallet 2 days ago, trademark. Yes. So
maybe,
you know, these people sometimes say one thing and do another, and it's the sentiment that you express, which is most common at market bottoms.
Explain what you were telling us about El Salvador harnessing the power of volcanoes.
There's a headline on the Bloomberg Terminal this morning that El Salvador has tabled a new securities law that would permit the government to transfer digital assets to and fro and would pave the way for them issuing a $1 billion bond on the Bitcoin network.
Would be the first sovereign blockchain bond, but they would use those proceeds to build essentially Bitcoin mines, what, on top of their volcanoes and use the geothermal energy as power?
There's a lot of carbon in the world that's stranded, not because it's dirty or there's no use for it economically, but because the nations or entities that control it don't have the resources to build high voltage transmission lines with all that copper and all that infrastructure. So El Salvador is one such case where they're rich in natural resources. It's a country full of volcanoes and geothermal energy, but there's no transmission down into the city. So they have built a Bitcoin mine, about 1 megawatt's worth of power at the top of the volcano as a test case so that they can print their own money rather than having the poorest country in the world's monetary policy tied to the monetary policy of one of the richest countries in the world. It never makes much sense. It's a real loss of sovereignty. El Salvador went to a dollar economy 40 years ago when they had a civil war. That increases a lot of domestic tension. So this Bitcoin gambit for them, the first country in the world to make Bitcoin legal tender, is a way of restoring sovereignty and introducing some degree of negotiating leverage versus an IMF who has become arguably rather heavy-handed in some of their demands.
So they can make Bitcoin with volcanoes.
I learned something new. I mean, this guy Matt Siegel, I don't know where
he was just in El Salvador. How is it? Were you spending Bitcoin when you were there?
Yes.
Yeah, so they use it.
They use it?
Yeah.
They paid for a surfing lesson in Bitcoin.
Paid for a surfing lesson in Bitcoin in El Salvador.
They use the Lightning Network, which is something I was... Yeah, they use the Lightning Network, which makes it easier to handle in terms of spending and receiving. But I think that's so cool.
You know, about 2% of El Salvador remittances are sent via the Bitcoin network. That may sound like a low number, but the country, about 20% of GDP is remittances. And the World Bank has a report that the corridors that have the highest fees for remittances are the poorest countries in the world. Okay. So this is a reason why Bitcoin can still provide value.
Have other countries followed El Salvador at all? Because it seems...
So one other country, Central African Republic, has also declared Bitcoin legal tender. Central African Republic uses the last colonial currency in existence, the CFA franc, where they are forced to deposit 50% of all their foreign exchange reserves at the Bank of France, who has veto power over how they are spent and who uses that to coerce the country into signing these commercial agreements where France gets right of first refusal on their natural resources. So if you look at like what the new Prime Minister of Italy has been highlighting, it's these types of colonial arrangements. You know, Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, they're a call option on a different financial future in which these arrangements are broken and neutral energy-based money, you know, grows. And that's kind of what Thomas Edison and Henry Ford suggested 100 years ago. You know, it seems hard to imagine now, but that's why the price of these assets are down 90% in the last year.
I want to get back to the Genesis Gemini story, which I think is fascinating. Really, the Genesis GBTC story. Does Barry Silbert find money for this hole?
If you look at the last time Genesis raised capital, it was exactly a year ago at the peak of the market. Nice job. It was at an equity value of $10 billion. SoftBank led that round. Google's venture arm also participated. So SoftBank doesn't have the money, right? They're owed $5 billion by Masayoshi Son. I don't see Google leading that round. So the existing investors, it seems like, are not going to put new money into this. Regulated institutions like banks, you know, still have regulatory uncertainty around it. So there likely has to be a new entity that puts money into it, or possibly a haircut.
And then GBTC, I mean, they're trading at, what, 45% below net asset value? How does that work out?
Bitcoin ETF could be approved under a different regulatory regime. That seems unlikely unless the HR department of this administration makes some changes. Otherwise, Grayscale could break the law and redeem anyway. They've been, I believe, have done that in the past and were censured by the SEC. That's a possibility. But raising capital and or haircuts seem the most likely option.
All right, we're getting into the weeds a little bit.
It's just ridiculous. We got to get this guy back in here.
Yes.
I mean, he knows what he's talking about. Matt Siegel, he's head of digital asset research. I don't know what the hell that is. But he's at VanEck, which is I just learned is a very cool
Paul just says that. He does know what it is.
Asset management firm and super duper smart. And he was a former producer here at Bloomberg Television, which is, of course,
minor stop along the
number
way.
Number one on his resume. We appreciate him coming in here. John Deere and Company, Deere & Co., symbol is DE on your Bloomberg terminal, $440.45 right now, up 5.7% today. It hit a 52-week high today, and it also hit an all-time high today. And that's saying something. This company went public back in 1981. All-time high today. Some good numbers out of Moline, Illinois. Chris
Giolino.
That's
good for America,
that's good
by the
for
way.
America. It's good for the farmers, boys.
We are internationally broadcast, so
that's right.
I'm not biased towards one country or the other, necessarily.
As you wear your green flannel shirt
but
and
I'm
your
happy.
Blue jeans.
I'm happy about this story
America.
For America.
Yep. Chris Giolino, he's happy. Equity research analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Chris, talk to us about this quarter. What's going right for Deere? What's the basis for their positive outlook?
Yeah, a lot's going right. It was a real solid quarter, and again, some pretty elevated expectations going into the print, and really driven by a very strong top line. Sales in the period were up, 40%. They were up 60% in their profitable large ag business, and that's really being driven by robust double-digit pricing and higher volume as some of these supply disruptions seem to be easing. Demand for farm equipment continues to be remarkably strong, and it really doesn't appear to be showing any signs of slowing into 2023. You have some healthy farm fundamentals. You have order books that already extend into the second half of next year. Inventories are tight. We have a lot of pent-up demand due to the supply challenges. So certainly a favorable setup for Deere heading into next year.
Tell us about the American farmer, Chris, because we don't know anything about it from here in New York. I am from the great state of Ohio, so I'm from the
Cornwall. I live in the Garden State. Does that mean anything?
I don't think they have farms there.
No, okay.
They do, obviously, have a lot of farming in Jersey as well. But, is the family farm still a thing? Are there small business farms? Are they mid-sized? Have corporate farms taken over? What is the state of the American farmer?
Yeah, so, you know, if you look at the health of the farm economy, especially over the last 3 years, it's been remarkably healthy. We're going to set another record this year for net farm income, and that's really being supported by these elevated crop prices that we're seeing, you know, part of that stemming from Russia's invasion of Ukraine and some adverse weather. So we think that's going to provide a favorable backdrop even as we move into next year, as some of those grain flows out of the Black Sea region are restricted, and then you also have a lack of fertilizer availability due to the war. So we think crop yields will still be somewhat lower, which is going to limit some of this replenishment of depleted grain stockpiles. So that's going to support this elevated crop price environment. That being said, farmers are also facing significantly higher input costs, whether it's fertilizer or fuel.
Diesel,
but
yeah.
Because of these higher grain prices, they're able to invest in equipment, which helps them be more productive and efficient on the farm, and ultimately drives higher profits for them. So long as crop prices are elevated, it's still supportive of spending on new equipment.
And the labor story at a Deere made headlines for a while. Has that been worked out? Is the union satisfied with what they got, or are there any strikes on the horizon?
Yeah, no, the UAW contract was ironed out earlier in this fiscal year for them. You know, labor across the industrial sector, you know, continues to be a problem. And labor, I think, is one of the headwinds that Deere and others will face as we move into next year. And you know, Deere's pouring a lot of money into autonomy and autonomous equipment. Labor and also the quality of labor is kind of an ongoing challenge on the farm. It's scarce. It's more costly. And autonomy can help mitigate some of the challenges that farmers face, not only getting the job done more efficiently, but also kind of in those optimal planning windows.
Hey, Chris, you know, if I go into a car lot these days, I don't have a lot to choose from. If I do find something, I got to pay MSRP, maybe even more than that. What's it like when I go on a Deere lot to buy a big tractor?
It's almost as bad.
Okay.
We are at, you know, historically low levels, particularly if you look at the large ag sector, which is really what moves the needle for Deere. We are significantly below historical levels. We will probably be below historical levels as we end next year as well. You know, there's so much demand out there and a lot of pent-up replacement from these multiple years of underproduction that, you know, Deere's just meeting retail demand right now. They can't even restock the dealer lots. So we think the restocking story could unfold into 2024, which should really help extend the ag cycle for Deere.
All right, very interesting stuff. And the stock has just been on fire. By the way, do you see the company taking advantage of the situation? Do they have a fair amount of their own shares in a war chest? Can they go and do some M&A? Is there anything like that going on in the space?
Yeah, you know, a lot of their investments, you know, they did a big deal for Wirtgen, which is a road construction equipment company a number of years back. So that should, you know, play favorably into the infrastructure bill here in the U.S. and really help kind of give them some scale globally. I think a lot of their M&A going forward will be more focused on maybe some smaller bolt-on deals around technology, autonomy, electrification, something that gives them, you know, additional technological capabilities that they haven't had. So I think that's probably where we're looking if they were to do some more M&A in the future.
What did they say about Ukraine? I'm guessing that's probably a big market for them. What are they saying?
In the big scheme of things, it's like, you know, Russia-Ukraine is like 2% of consolidated revenue. You know, they've, you know, suspended operations and taken some write-offs there. Really not that different from any other industrial company. That being said, it is important global commodity market, particularly with wheat and corn. So, you know, that's part of the reason why we were kind of in this elevated crop price environment and probably will be for the next couple of years.
Well, I would not be surprised if they have suppliers there as well. You know, a lot of auto production gets wire harnesses, for example, from Ukraine.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, they produce a lot of gear over there, but obviously they're not in the equation right now. So that hurts in a lot of ways. It also changes the picture, as Chris is explaining, in terms of, you know, crop prices,
yeah,
which plays out to be to their benefit. Chris, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope we can get you back on the show. Chris Chialino there, equity research analyst from Bloomberg Intelligence, talking to us about Deere, the stock trading at an all-time high right now. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.